back together. There's power in a union of many lands.
And discuss most anything you want to. Your thoughts, your ideas, your stories are, of course, welcome. A gentle reminder as we begin the program tonight that, as usual, we're looking for around between 60 and 100 bucks on any given night just to keep things at an even keel as far as fundraising goes. That's 6 to 10 members of the Thrifty 250. And at the $10 a month limit, that means that the program's coming to you for about 5 cents an hour. Actually less. So the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The snail mail address is there, too. With regard to the snail mail address, just remember two things. Canadian postal money orders cannot be cashed or by the bank that we use. And secondly, things should be made payable to The Horn, Head on Radio Network, things like that, not Bob Kincaid. Just saying. If you're using the snail mail. No issues with the PayPal. So there we go. No, we find ourselves beginning this evening after some stirring conversation of the last couple of nights. It's been a good week, I think. And we will, we can go a number of places, but I want to hit the mailbag first, by the way, just to let you know, our buddy Tom in California said, thanks for the info on TuneIn Radio. Got it set up this morning and connected to the stream in the car on the way to work. Cool. I'll be able to listen live for a change. That's big. That's big. Being able to listen in the car, just like terrestrial radio, is sort of points the way toward the future. So thanks for letting us know, Tom. And try it yourselves if you've got some sort of a smartphone. There's a number of ways, different ways to get the show. And TuneIn Radio is a really handy little app. They've got it for iPhone and for Android devices as well. So there's that. I love the idea of being in the car. And it's kind of like the horn has been untethered from the computer speakers, you know? And this, this came in from Cassie last night. And I understand her meaning and what she was getting at. Based upon our conversation, Sandra and I, where we touched on issues relating to foster care, and we're talking about Michelle Bachmann and Marcus, the M&M Bachmanns, and remarked on the fact that they had had a foster care mill over the course of their career as part of the means by which they got both front trotters in the trough, the public trough, that is. It was Tracy who was talking. Cassie says, please don't disparage foster parents. On your call with Tracy, you made it sound like most foster parents are in it for the money, and it sounded for a minute like you were also critical of the fact that they took in only girls. No, when you talk about the fact that the Bachmanns took in only girls, it's kind of unique. I mean, taking only one gender or another is not unique, but there's something kind of unique to the Bachmanns doing it. If you've ever, seen video of Marcus Bachmann, I wouldn't want little boys in that house either. As you and the audience know, Cassie says, I spent my last year and a half of high school living with a family that has taken in foster children for the past 15 years. They only take in girls because they have daughters, and they think life is less complicated if all the kids in the house are girls. That makes perfect sense. And Cassie speaks very highly of the people who were her family during the last year and a half of high school. She says, these people are saints. They take care of kids who need a place to stay and a family to love. And I guarantee you they're not in it for the money. They received 17 monthly military dependent stipend payments for my care in the time I stayed with them, and then gave me every penny of that money when I left for college. I go back to visit for Christmas each year because they're the most loving and stable family I've ever known, even if some of the faces around the table change from one year to the next. And that's beautiful. That is the way it is supposed to work. I know there are horrible foster parents out there, says Cassie, and they're the ones who make the news, but most of them are in it for the kids they care for and not for the business of foster care. You have a megaphone and you know my story, and I hope that you'll encourage people to open their homes and their hearts. It makes a huge difference to kids in difficult situations, and I agree wholeheartedly. But I do not, I can't ascribe those kinds of motives to the Bachmann family. I just can't. Because every move they've ever made was calculated to suck money out of the federal trough at the same time that 1L Michelle stands in Congress and screams about big government. Right? Let's see. Then this. One of those little slice of lice. No, Bob, not slice of lice. One of those little slice of life notes. Dr. John writing in from New York. Bob, I'm spending the day shopping with my lovely wife. I just spot-checked 50, yes, 50 pairs of shoes, men's and women's, at a large warehouse-type shoe retailer. I was looking at the country of origin labels. Oh, boy. Guess how many were U.S. made? One, actually, a pair of New Balance. Don't get too excited, though. The pair next to it was from China, also New Balance. The frenzy of the people inside, their total obliviousness to any sense that there was a whole world behind the thing they were buying, was stunning. I wonder if I had said something like, yeah, good price, but why not buy shoes made in the USA? Would I have gotten any response? And yes, you can buy U.S.-made shoes. My Carolina work boots not only note the factory in PA they were made in, but the local of the union whose workers put them together. Carolina boots just went to the top of the list. John says, excuse the rant and spelling. I'm a bit steamed up. I don't think there's anything to excuse there. it would be nice to be able to go and get something that doesn't have Made in China on it. Of course, I remember a generation ago when everybody was complaining that it had Made in Japan on it. But there really was a difference then. And the difference was that the Japanese manufacturers were kicking our butts in quality. That's where the problem came from a generation ago. The modern problem does not come from the ability of the American worker to produce a good product. The problem now comes from the predatory corporate desire to pay pennies per hour for labor as opposed to dollars. And there really is a big distinction. And I know a little bit about this, or had it, and thank you very much, John, for pointing that out. I'd love to be able to have a pair of American-made dress shoes for when the rare occasions when I have to put on a suit. And like I said, Carolina just went way up to the top of the list for me when it comes to trying to find boots that'll keep my feet warm and dry in freezing, snowy weather. When I first bought a pair of Rocky brand boots, they were made in Cambridge, Ohio. And they stood behind their boots so thoroughly. I think the first pair of Rockies I had, I wore for 5 years before a drop of water ever got in. And I'd put them through some stuff by then. But they had a warranty on them, and I wrote in and said, you know, will you tell me where I can send these boots so that you can make them dry again? They wrote back and said, no, just get rid of those and a new pair is on the way. And then, of course, it all moved to China, and Rocky boots aren't fit to wear anymore. And it's all over the place. I'm a little, I guess, scatterbrained today because we are, well, the word celebrating isn't appropriate, but we're marking the one-week anniversary of Agnes and Ferg getting the bejesus slammed out of them by a guy doing highway speeds who never even stepped on his brake when he struck him. And today, the fun began. Well, it began and it ended. Today I dealt with the property insurance adjuster, the property damage adjuster. And this is one of those things that's so very frustrating, because the ignorant jackass who hit my wife and son gets to benefit from the fact that I'm kind of frugal. He gets to benefit from the fact that instead of going out and buying a new car every 5 years, I have held on to that truck for 16. Because, no, cosmetically, it was, you know, we joke, I call it the Rusty Red Pickup Truck. Rusty for short. But it was in good shape. It went where I needed to go. It had torque to climb a tree. For what it was, a big old honking 5.9 liter V8, got good gas mileage out on the highway. You know, if you're getting 20 miles a gallon out of a 5.9 liter V8 engine, you're doing good, and it always has. That's not to say that it's something you want to drive across country in, because it's not. It was very low mileage. It only had 136,000 miles on it. And so the insurance adjuster shows up and he goes over every last jot and tittle of my truck and establishes, and well, he says, well, you know, the cost of replacing the bed totals the vehicle. And I have no say-so in this. Because to him, it's just a vehicle with minimal value because it's old and not pretty. But to me, well, you know, when Tom Robbins, the novelist, wrote Still Life with Woodpecker, he talked about the life of objects. And I understand some of that. Especially now. It's not just an ugly old truck. That's the truck that carried my wife in labor on a Christmas night when the snow was 2 feet deep in the rural holler where we lived and the interstate was just a field of 2 foot deep snow. But in four-wheel drive, we carefully crept our way out the holler and over the mountains and onto the highway and down to Charleston, where some 15 hours later, my son was born. It's the truck that carried me as a nervous wreck from West Virginia to Alabama as I went to try to reach my mother's bedside before she died. It's been a lot of truck. It took me up the logging road up the side of Gauley Mountain the first time I saw up close what mountaintop removal meant for my community. It's carried equipment to Concord University for the PRISM lecture series. And it's pretty much done. No, unfortunately, Cindy writing in, you do have a say. You can insist that your insurance company force the person at fault to replace the truck for one of equal value. Don't accept the dollars. Doesn't work that way. Doesn't work that way. So basically, the guy who hit my wife and son it gets a benefit, and the insurance company gets an even bigger one. Because even if you tried the case, you still wouldn't be able to sue for more than the value of the truck. They don't take into account emotional value or history or, you know, no. It's a part of the overall philosophy of how we view lives and how we view the interaction between lives and property and what we call value. Because I wouldn't have sold that truck for what it's going to be basically paid for. And I damn sure can't buy another one with it. But that is the advantage, and this is not me moaning and groaning about poor Bob's life, not at all. No, no, no. Don't take, that's not the takeaway on this. The takeaway on this is that we have a lot to think about in this country. And in the future of this country. We have a lot to think about in terms of what we want out of an economy. Just because we have an economy that is found, that is at present founded upon predatory practices and principles does not mean that it always has to be that way. We can do better. I have an example of doing better. Y'all know I trust about the company called Patagonia. Now, granted, they don't make all their stuff in the United States. I wish they did. Some of their stuff is at least made of fabric that was made in the United States. And it's pricey stuff. But it's good stuff. And it's especially good stuff because Patagonia, as a corporation, walks the walk and talks the talk. Every year, for several years now, Patagonia, for instance, has supported in ways larger or smaller than, but has supported and is aware of Coal River Mountain Watch's work to end the horrors that coal companies foist upon us every day, to end the poisoning that happens inside the wombs of expectant mothers, to end the cancers that burn unknown and unimagined inside people all throughout Central Appalachia because of profiteering coal companies. I like Patagonia. I wish I could afford to wear Patagonia. Somewhere along the way, I'll try to get a hoodie or a shirt or something just to support them because they support our work. And Patagonia did something today that falls right in line with that discussion of what does the economy we want look like? What do the structures within the economy that we want look like? A new law went into effect in California today. And it's sort of a bold new approach to doing business. And it is an outright rejection of the excesses that are attendant upon predatory profiteering. The name of the thing is called a benefit corporation, and today Patagonia filed to become a benefit corporation. The law in California was just approved recently. And what it does is it gives some breathing room to companies that want to be moral, want to be decent, so that they are not straitjacketed by current business laws that say that the only purpose of a corporation is to grind out profit at all costs, which is basically the ethics of business. I mean, that's business ethics. Being a benefit corporation means that one may actually, in the course and ordinary course and scope of business, one may actually take into account social costs, social effects, environmental costs, environmental effects, things that have, that they can internalize, things that have been externalized. And in all of that, they are shielded from a shareholder suit, from cranky coupon clippers saying, "Well, by God, your profits aren't high enough. You know, why aren't you using 12-year-old Chinese children to make your crap? We'd have more profits if you did that." Yeah, honey, did we send out our check to the Republican National Committee yet today? There are 7 states in the United States so far that permit benefit corporations to exist. California, among them. Let's see, Vermont and Maryland permit benefit corporations. New York, New Jersey, Virginia, and Hawaii do as well. And about 100 companies have become benefit corporations in those various and sundry states. It's very clear, by statute, no court can hold a benefit corporation liable for not profiteering enough. and it tells shareholders, listen, you'll make money, but you're not going to make it on the backs of people affected by the things that we as a corporation determined that we are concerned about. So I applaud Patagonia. And you might want to, if you're not in one of those seven states, you might want to maybe talk to your state legislators about creating a benefit corporation statute in your state or commonwealth. Jared Huffman is a Democrat from San Rafael, California. He authored AB 361, creating the benefit corporation in California. He said, there is a way to create jobs and grow the economy while raising the bar for social and environmental responsibility. With this new law, we are attracting new, socially conscious companies, investors, and consumers. Pointing out specifically that this is an attempt to not be constrained by the old basically Delaware model of profit, 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 damn it, profit, more profit! Two-thirds of the way it works is two-thirds of a company's outstanding shareholders need to vote in favor to become a benefit corporation, and it's got to have the same thing to go back. This has huge potential. What corporation that has voted to become one of these things wouldn't tout it on their website, wouldn't make it a point to encourage people to do business with them because they're not operating the same old dirty way? I found it quite encouraging when I read this story over at Crooks and Liars, especially in light of the fact that I spent the day dealing with the merciless, remorseless profiteering side of the business world. Screw you and your truck. You know. No, nothing has yet been signed. And no, Cindy, there was not comprehensive coverage on it. I don't have that kind of money. And putting comprehensive and collision and everything on a truck with 136,000 miles really isn't worth the premium. So, yeah. No, that's the decision. David in Tennessee asking if it means I've got to turn over the title. That's the decision I'm making. The next step now will be to go down and talk to the mechanic and say, listen, can we get her back on the road legal? And if the answer is yes, then we'll do the salvage buyback. And if the answer is no, we'll take the box where Carol Merrill is now standing. So that's been my day's adventure. And I'm sure many of you have been through something similar. It's no fun. Once upon a time in the state of West Virginia, you had the right to hold a third-party insurer accountable. Joe Manchin was instrumental in making sure that was taken away from us. You get the idea. Sandra asking, I hope you plan to sue for future health problems. Yeah, this is only the property damage side of it. The other side, I called an old lawyer buddy of mine, and he said, oh, sure. And we'll take care of it that way. Because Agnes and Ferg both are scheduled for MRIs because Agnes's arm is screwed up, and I think they're going to look at her head too, and they're going to. They meant to do a CT of Ferg's lumbar region, but they messed up and did one of his head and neck last week when we spent from 5 p.m. to 3 a.m. in the ER. It really was. It was like something out of MASH. So we don't. They're not even done treating. But they're both still sore as hell. Agnes is moving kind of slow. So that's where the conversation begins this evening. I don't want to get all obsessive compulsive about Rick Santorum, but he's the flavor of the week. And where there's an opportunity to sort of drive the nail, I'm going to drive it. And I found another one of those today. You remember a couple of nights ago we talked at length about how Rick Santorum pulled his old grandpappy out of the dirt and flogged him for a little while for votes and political admiration and such like. And I still wish, I don't have time to do journalism, so to speak. I'm going to put a few feelers out and see if anybody's interested in following up on the history that he recounts of his immigrant grandpappy who was paid in coupons. Because you remember in that story, he said after a while, he realized he wasn't getting anywhere and he started getting paid in money. Now, I know a lot of people who knew, had parents, grandparents, old-timers, who can tell you about the days. And they didn't offer you the option of, would you like to be paid less in American money, or would you like to take company scrip? You took the company scrip. And the numbers have been, the dates and stuff have been rattling around in my head. He starts mining coal when he's 1925 in southwest Pennsylvania in Somerset County. And I'm not trying to just go on about this. I smell a fraud. Something is rotten. Something is Santorum in the state of Denmark, okay? The National Labor Relations Act was signed under FDR in, help me here, 33, 34, 35, that specifically acknowledged unions' rights to exist. And I'm pretty sure that the UMWA went in and organized hard in the coal-producing areas of western Pennsylvania. So you got to wonder how it is that Mr. Santorum would have continued to work up into the 1950s, at the least, and probably into the 60s, if not the early 70s. And avoided the UMWA. I need some input here from a Pennsylvania labor expert like Rick Smith. Could it be that Grandpap really? No. Could it be that he wasn't a? Well, maybe he was a scab to begin with, a replacement worker. But maybe he later became a dues-paying union member and good American. That might be important to find out. Because, you see, this latest story that has came out today from the New York Times talks about what happened to Bro Fromix, the frothy one, after he was thrown out of the Senate by the people of the state of the Commonwealth. Is it a state or a Commonwealth? Pennsylvania. And it talks about how all these corporations lined up to be nice to Ricky because Ricky had been nice to them. Ricky, you've got some splaining to do. Let's see, there was a Pennsylvania for-profit hospital corporation called Universal Health Services. And he'd been very, very friendly with them during his tenure in the Senate of the United States. And it turns out that they own hospitals in Puerto Rico. And Mr. Small Government Santorum busted his little tuchus getting Medicare money flowing to those hospitals in Puerto Rico. Ricky was sad to have to leave the Senate. But things, well, it's always darkest just before it starts raining money. Because it was just a matter of months, according to the New York Times, after the frothy one left the Senate, that Universal Health Services, to whom he had pumped millions upon millions of your dollars via Medicare, which we support and like, into Universal Healthcare's coffers, well, lo and behold, there's Universal Healthcare. Mr. Santorum? Mr. Santorum? Are you there? Rick, it's not any of those hateful gay people. It's us. Remember us? Universal Healthcare? You helped us get millions and millions and millions of taxpayer dollars for our hospitals in Puerto Rico? Yeah. Yes, of course. Well, we were wondering if you might come down to the office later this week and, oh, I don't know, have some coffee and cookies with us? Because we just want to let you know that we think you're really special. And if you come down to the office and you have some coffee and cookies with us, and it just turns out that there's $395,000, sitting next to your coffee cup, well, wouldn't that be fun? Because that's what happened. The door had barely hit Rick Santorum in the butt on the way out of the Senate when Universal Health Services invited him to take a seat on their board for the low, low Kmart price of $395,000 in director's fees and stock options. And he held on to that until he resigned last year once he got the presidential itch. Yeah. But that's not all. No. Remember him flogging on his grandpappy, the coal miner? Well, while he was in office, the frothy one had been a great friend to a little company, just a little mom-and-pop organization called CONSOL. C-O-N-S-O-L. CONSOL. And they wanted to have coffee and cake with Ricky, too. And lo and behold, there it is. He sits down, and there's the coffee, and there's the cake, and there's another stack of money. In this case, CONSOL hired the frothy one to be a consultant. He consulted, apparently real good for CONSOL. Mm-hmm. Who's CONSOL? Well, CONSOL is what we like to call around here an effing coal company. I add the effing in front of CONSOL because CONSOL is the effing coal company who blew the effing daylights out of the mountain that used to sit over top of the little town near where I live. It used to be called Golly Knob, Golly Mountain, now it's just a toxic waste area. But he was a consultant. The story in the New York Times quotes a guy named John Brabender. Go figure. He's a senior advisor to the frothy campaign. And he said it would be wrong to link his consulting work with anything he did in the Senate. Of course it would. Because it might not make the frothy one look bad. But is his appearance our fault? The New York Times sought out Lisa Say, S-E-A-Y. She's a spokeswoman for Consol. And she said, given his long and well-documented efforts aimed at providing American consumers with affordable energy, we wanted Mr. Santorum to provide strategic counsel on a variety of public policy-related issues. Really? Rick, we were planning on... there's this little town down in West Virginia, and we thought we'd just blow the snot out of the mountain that sits just a mile or so from a couple of national parks and one state park. And well, what do you think about that, Rick, from a public policy related issue standpoint? What's your strategic counsel on that, Rick? Blow it up! Blow it to kingdom come. There aren't any fetuses there. I don't give a damn. See, that's the problem. I maintain that one cannot be pro-life, as Rick Santorum claims to be, and also be pro-coal. It's a little bit like trying to be a vegan butcher or a Christian Satanist. They're wholly incompatible. Babies are maturing inside mothers' wombs right now in central Appalachia, even as we speak. And as we speak, toxins, profound and poisonous toxins, are finding their way into those little fetal bodies. Those toxins are there at that special moment that gets Rick Santorum all tingly. When egg meets sperm, they meet in a womb that's decorated in selenium and barium and cadmium and arsenic and mercury and aluminum and magnesium and manganese. And there they become one. And that precious little fetus that Rick Santorum gets so excited about begins to grow. But it doesn't grow right. Maybe it grows with a heart defect or a pulmonary aberration. Or maybe its brain doesn't form quite correctly, so it'll think in some fashion that we refer to as normal. Maybe its kidneys won't be right. Maybe its liver will be born with a liver burned up. All of those things and more, you see, are possible if that baby is in that womb and the woman with the womb is in a county where mountaintop removal is happening. It's scientifically proven. It's not challengeable. It's just, what's the word we're looking for here? Oh, yeah, a fact. And it's a fact whether Alpha Natural Resources does it, whether Arch does it, whether Patriot does it, or whether Consol does it. And Consol does it. They did it right above my home. And above my neighbor's homes. And the little subsidiary captive company that does all the work and is still working, they're pumping filth and poison into creeks and streams that drain into the Gauley River every day. And when they were setting off blasts, the airborne materials were blowing right over us. Ah, that smells like... No, that doesn't smell like toxic poison. No, that smells like profit. Don't reckon there's much chance of Consol Energy becoming a public benefit corporation anytime soon, is there? Nah. Profit, baby. It's all about the profit. And that's the kind of hypocrisy that you have to get used to if we're going to watch this this thing unfold. Melanie Sloan is Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. She said, Santorum is portraying himself as this outsider when he was really the ultimate insider. And what an insider he was. Quoting the newspaper article from the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported in 2006 that Mr. Santorum and Pennsylvania's other senator at the time, Arlen Specter, claimed credit for millions of dollars in earmarks to firms represented by the American Continental Group, a lobbying firm that participated in Rick Santorum's K Street breakfast meetings. In July 2009, American Continental Group invited Rick over for coffee and cake and $65,000 in cash for legislative policy consulting services. The Times also continues, Mr. Santorum's efforts involving the gas exploration and coal industries were beneficial to Consol Energy in broader ways. He sponsored bills to expand offshore drilling, joined Consol in promoting mine safety.
Ho, ho, ho!
1,000 miners a year. They run underground mines, too, you see. 1,000 miners a year still die from black lung. Some of those are Consol retirees or maybe even people who aren't retired yet. He was the keynote speaker for a conference on financial market regulation organized by a group headed by a Consol executive. He stopped working for Consol when he started his presidential campaign. Right. He joined Consol as a consultant in July of 2007. Andy noting by email, thanks for summarizing today's New York Times piece. When Santorum left the Senate, familiar hands reached out, and the photograph is there. And Andy says, look at the smirk on this pig's face in the picture. What a ruthless, greedy, immoral, and money-grubbing scumbag. Gee, I think Andy nailed it. Scumbag. And he is that. He absolutely is that. In case you were wanting proof, well, there's this. And this has, well, it tangentially it ties in, because you see, one of the things that comes with mountaintop removal is, and it's just like that box of Captain Crunch you were so eager to get into as a kid because there was a decoder ring in the bottom or something, and doting, indulgent mothers would sometimes get the mixing bowl out so you could dump all the cereal out and get the ring. And then put all the cereal back in. Well, cancer is like the secret decoder ring inside mountaintop removal. Wherever you have mountaintop removal, you have cancer. And most notably, since we were talking about fetuses a minute ago, the cancers happen in children. They happen in perfectly healthy 23-year-old young men. Perfectly healthy. Non-smokers, non-drinker, non-snuff-dipper, don't-cuss, go-to-church-on-Sunday types. And then you bury them, because they're dead from the cancer that doesn't just happen. And especially doesn't happen in the places the cancer happened. You get the idea. So the frothy mixture was in Keene, New Hampshire earlier today, where he was questioned about, because he's been prattling on about how Obamacare must die, you know, because, yes, they're making dependent on government, and we're not free anymore. Free, we're not free to crawl off into a corner and die a miserable, agonizing death like Jesus wants you to. Right? Yeah. It, by the way, well, we won't go there. But anyway, so a mother stands up to ask the frothy one a little question about insurance. Hold on, I want you to hear it all. Danged if that one didn't load fast for a change. You'll have that. Keene, New Hampshire.
And then also that your comment was that it was poor judgment that they choose not to go to the doctor at the right time, although most people without health care don't have a doctor to go to, or that they choose not to go to the emergency room at the right time.
Well, I think that is true. A lot of people don't make good decisions on health care because we don't, as I was talking about before, we are not particularly well educated because on the issue of health care as consumers.
Now, I also happen to be an emergency room nurse going on 30 years next month.
Oops.
So therefore, I have to tell you that I know lots of Americans over my 30 years that have died from lack of health care that did go to the emergency room, but not soon enough. But my real question for you comes in regards to something very personal. I'm the mother of a cancer survivor, my son. And your comments that people don't make the right choices. I made the right choices when I was pregnant with him, did everything right. He was 5 years old when he was diagnosed with cancer. He made no choice to get that cancer. He was treated for 3.5 years, and I'm really proud to say that he graduated college 2.5 weeks ago. I want to know, your comments are all important because he's a wonderful son and child, but the comments I heard you make in New Hampshire, comments that you support insurance companies' the right to refuse to insure people with pre-existing conditions, and that you also agreed with higher premiums for people that are sick. When my son graduated college, and I pray that he gets a good job, why is it all right? Why do you think it's okay for him to possibly be denied health care insurance or have to pay a fee that he won't be able to afford, or perchance a company not to hire him because he was 5 years old and he got cancer?
Don't you want to hug her? Not a big old rousing go, sister, or anything like that. Don't you just want to hug her? Because the first time I heard this clip, I did. I had a little tear well up in my eye. Because there, right there on display, for the frothy mixture himself to see, is American Family Values. A woman who has worked 30 years in an emergency room, who has seen the very worst that a healthcare system predicated on profiting from the agony, the sickness, the illness, the misery, and death of her fellow Americans. She's seen the worst that it has to offer. And when she left her long shifts at the emergency room, for a truly terrifying part of her life. She struggled to see her 5-year-old boy get to be a 6-year-old boy. And here he is. He's graduated college. And the frothy one has opined, as she notes, that that intelligent young man should be open for discrimination by insurance companies for things over which he had no choice. I say all this because that was her question. You have not yet heard Rick Santorum's answer. Here's a hint. I'll give you 10 seconds to go get the vomit bucket. Because you're going to want it. Are we there yet? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Insurance works where people who are higher risk end up having to pay more as they should. You say, in your case, your son, absolutely. He obviously did nothing wrong. Obviously, there are a lot of other people who did a lot of things that increased their health risk that did do things wrong, and as a result, result in higher health care costs. So, of course, you always have cases. If it was all the same case as your son, then maybe you could make the argument, well, nobody did anything to cause their health care, their instance of health care costs to go up. But
nobody did anything to cause your son's incidence of cancer health care costs to go up. What do you say then when you're dealing with a mama hillbilly who has done nothing, who has been the perfect mother during the gestation of her child? Because you see, that's what Dr. Michael Hendricks' research proved via the incredibly detailed analysis of over 1 million Appalachian births. Mama, who doesn't smoke, who doesn't do any of the bad things, no drinking, not even so much as a drop of the communion wine that Rick Santorum would condemn her to hell for not drinking. None of that. All she has to do is be breathing in and breathing out and feeling the tiny kicks of that little child inside her in a county where maybe Rick's pals from Consol Energy are blowing the snot out of a mountain. And that woman, that perfect mother's baby's chances of getting born with a birth defect of grave consequence, her chances are something on the order of between 40 and 80% higher than if she lived in a county where MTR was not taking place and was smoking like a chimney. Now, who should pay for what the frothy one refers to as that increased risk? I'm sure it couldn't possibly be his buddies, the guys who write the big Jed Clampett walking around money checks over at Consol. Now, could it? Of course not.
Higher risk, end up having to pay more as they should. You say, in your case, your son, absolutely. He obviously did nothing wrong. Obviously, there are a lot of other people who did a lot of things that increased their health risk that did do things wrong, and as a result, result in higher health care costs. So, of course, you always have cases. If it was all the same case as your son, then maybe you can make the argument, well, nobody did anything to cause their health care, their incidence of health care costs to go up. But, of course, that's not the case. And so you have to have...
What? Maybe you could make the argument, but that's not the case? Because, see, there was, as a longtime reader and listener of the English language, there's a lot of gobbledygook in there, but he just told her, maybe you could make the argument, but that's not the case. He just called her a liar. Okay.
You have to have some, as we do with life insurance. Some people pay more for life insurance. Why? Because you smoke. Because you have things...
Yeah, there he was, 5 years old, honking on a pack of Camels.
...that cause higher morbidities. You have things that cause higher healthcare costs. And therefore, we, as part of a marketplace, why should we charge some people more who have done all the things that are necessary than someone... So there is a reason to do this. You make a very good case about your son... And maybe there's something
but
that,
screw
that
him.
Companies can do to sort of factor those things in.
Yeah, maybe there's a thing, something a company could do to factor those in. You notice where he puts the emphasis? It's all about the marketplace. And that is exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about reinventing what we want an economy to be. How can a society that calls itself civilized allow something as profane and filthy as a market to determine whether or not an innocent lives or dies? How can we do that? I submit to you that a moral country, an ethical country, a society that does not, that chooses not to consume and eat its own, cannot do that. And that therefore tells you that this obscene, Randian, anarcho-predatory filth machine cannot in any wise be ever considered anything remotely related to civilized. It just can't.
But that's to suggest everybody pays the same is in fact a penalty on people who are doing the right thing and not necessarily for people who weren't doing the right thing.
For everybody to pay the same price is a penalty on people who are doing the right thing? Bullshit! For everyone to pay the same price is merely a recognition that we are all ineffably, inexorably, and irretrievably human. That none are better than the others. But you can't make statements like that when you believe that the market is more important than life, and hence the last nail in the coffin of all of his pro-life sickening hypocrisy. He doesn't believe in the sanctity of human life, because if he believed in the sanctity of human life, he could not stand there and say what he has said. Because he is putting insurance company premiums ahead of that very human life. And the whole reason he got this question is because of his response to another question elsewhere in New Hampshire. Why did I say Connecticut? Merrimack, New Hampshire, back in December. This goes to the Rick Santorum's greatest hits file. You're all probably familiar with it. It was this statement. I had insurance under my employer. Who? Oh, you mean the people of the United States? And when I decided to run for president, oh no, that would be one of those three, at least, groups that he had tea and cookies with who sat money by the saucer. When I left my job, I lost my insurance. I had to go out and buy insurance on the open market. We have a child who has a pre-existing condition, and we went out and we said, we like this plan. We have to pay more because she has a pre-existing condition. We should pay more. She's going to be very expensive to the insurance company, and you know, that cost is passed along to us. I'm okay with that. Now, he's saying that the pre-existing condition just cost more. What about when the pre-existing condition is straight up a reason for, no, sorry, you can't have insurance? He wasn't turned down because he's Rick Effin Santorum, friend of fetuses. More importantly, Rick Effin Santorum, friend of corporations. Insurance rates shouldn't pay for your general maintenance any more than they should pay for the general maintenance of your car. Should they pay for the operation? Well, just as much as they should pay for the car accident? I think we're back to that paper towel is not a mug of beer thing. This man has no reverence for any life save his own. Michael writing in. Kid A from the chat room. Bro Fromix question. Is this the same Bro Fromix that has a dying little 3-year-old girl, or am I mixing him up with another candidate? No, that's the same one. You're right there, Michael. You're right there. Meanwhile, a different Michael. That ER nurse. With a quote, how wise Dickens was to make readers feel poverty and cruelty through the fate of children who had not reached the age where the righteous and comfortable classes could accuse them of being responsible for their own misery. Those words from Howard Zinn. Of course, Zinn was being generous or couldn't comprehend the modern American Repiglican. Because that's what he's talking about. Oh, it's your fault. You made poor choices. See, you could have become a U.S. Senator and walked around getting your palms greased, and when you got your ass bounced for being a weirdo who calls people Nazis for bringing you a cold cup of coffee, well, then you get to sit down and go to work for coal companies and for-profit health insurance, health hospital companies, and K Street lobbyists, and they make you wealthy, and that's how it's supposed to be, and, you know, it's your poor choices in life. That didn't happen for you. It's not the fact that there's only 100 members of the damn Senate. Andy adding, Bob, he's got his. He's taken care of by Universal Healthcare and Consol, so F all of you. F you, I got mine, baby. A typical Republican hypocrite. Amen, Andy. This from Tim. Bob, so why can the I dare you to Google them Santorums receive affordable health care when, one, Karen aborted, or murdered, as Tim says, and expelled a dead baby because of birth complications, which would have killed Karen, playing God, huh? Two, Karen, I dare you to Google Santorum, now has a pre-existing condition. I wonder if any occupiers or the media will bring this up when Rick, I dare you to Google Santorum, visits their state. And see, that's the thing. That wonderful woman, the ER nurse, was profound and polite. And I applaud her. Because I recognize it's no way to get anything accomplished, but how do you not look at this guy and go, okay, here's my question, Mr. Santorum, you effing monster. You sick bastard. You sorry sack of... pustulant humanity, you miserable misanthrope. See that? See, that's that Bob. He's calling names. And it's not something that we flog. I won't flog it. But the other night, when he was talking about his little girl, the one who's their angel that doesn't travel with them, and yet his wife was standing right there. Who was looking after the angel, Rick? You didn't just leave her in the hands of the Almighty now, did you? She doesn't travel well. She doesn't handle crowds well. Karen was standing right there, though. How could you stand? Yeah. Oh, she's our angel. How could you stand to leave her? How many other American families are there who put everything on hold to stay near a little one struggling for life? How many, you reckon? How many? Bunch, don't you figure? But not Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum, he's got ambitions to service. And he needs his abortant wife right there with him. I would never criticize a woman for the choice that she makes about her private, intensely personal world. But I will criticize hypocrisy. And she is a hypocrite no less than he, pure and simple. So it's 12 minutes past the hour. It's also Friday on the front porch. Got a couple of lines open yet. We'll come to your calls out of the break. Light them up and fire them up if you want to. You know the number, 304-658-3333. That's the direct dial number that's on your nickel. If you need us to carry the freight, you can dial in at 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4, H-E-A-D-O-N. Head On. That's the name of the program. Head On with Bob Kincaid. I just happen to be Bob Kincaid, who you can reach via email, if you prefer that method, at Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Quit school when she was 17. Senator on TV calls her welfare queen. Used to be daddy's little girl. Now she needs help in this mean old world. Buys cassette tapes in the bargain bin. Loves Carlene Carter and Loretta Lynn. Tries to have fun on a Saturday night. Sunday morning don't shine too bright. It's welfare music. Watch the baby dance to the welfare music. Will she ever stand a chance? Nobody understands. Baby, get up. Baby needs a drink from a loving cup. It's welfare music. Watch the baby dance.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Total Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap! There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Total Genius. We got your soap right here.
And other bath and body stuff.
www.doublegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
It is time indeed to go to the phones on this here Friday on the front porch. Looking forward to it. Great conversations always. So let us not stand upon the order of our going, but go at once. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi, it's Paul from Portland.
Oh, hey, Paul. How are you? Thanks for the note and the contents of the change jar.
Oh, yeah. Don't forget to contact me on that other thing on the PS.
Yes.
So I know where to send it.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. I just am getting ready to go back to school here Monday.
Okay. How's school?
Don't know yet. Starts Monday.
Yeah. Okay. Let me try that again. How's it been?
Tough. Busy, working hard, but pulled a couple A's and an A minus last quarter, so...
Awesome. Awesome. Outstanding.
Thank you, sir. I need you to strap in here, because I had a thought occur while I was listening to you. and I need you to hold on to something.
Okay. I got my bite stick.
Okay. Is Rick Santorum the Tim Tebow of the Republican race?
Actually, if you rate, interesting you would ask that, because I got sent the article by two different people. If you read Dave Zirin over at The Nation this week, you found out that Michelle Bachmann is the Tim Tebow of the Republican race.
I didn't get that message.
you might want to go read it. It's a, oh man, what an article it is. Because, well, he points out some rather stunning, similarities between the two.
Cool. Well, I just wanted to talk to you about a couple things. One, something I need your opinion on, and maybe Sandra can chip in here, too.
Okay.
Shifting into football talk here for all the Horn listeners, so prepare yourselves. I am originally from Seattle, and I'm a huge Seattle Seahawks fan. And back in 2000...
You are a long-suffering soul, in other words.
Yes. Back in 2006, they were at the Super Bowl and got beaten by Pittsburgh. And that was a very tough game with a couple of very controversial referee calls. One of them being whether Roethlisberger QB sneaked successfully into the end zone. It was a tough call, and they challenged it, they gave it to him, and then that jackass had enough gall to go on the Letterman show and go, well, I even didn't think I got it in. And I'm just like, you just need to say it was a tough game, and it was a close call, and they were a good team. You don't need to say, I didn't think I got it in, but they gave it to me, so yay for me. So I've been rooting against the Pittsburgh Steelers ever since, as long as Roethlisberger's quarterback, but I don't like the Denver Broncos either. So I am really confused about who I want to lose more in the upcoming Broncos-Steelers game.
You know, okay, full disclosure, I got turned into a Steelers fan way back a million years ago when I rode my dinosaur to school, and all of my fraternity brothers were from Pittsburgh. I wouldn't have lasted long. I just wouldn't have.
My problem isn't with Pittsburgh. It's with Roethlisberger. Last year when he had twisted his ankle, Pittsburgh was a great team. And they proved that they could play without him. I'm all for that.
Right, I understand. So it's a question of who do you despise more, Tim Tebow or, as he's been known to be referred to here, Ben Roethlisberger. And, again... Have we ever seen Ben Roethlisberger point his fingers at or say that, you know, God helped him hit Hines Ward or anything like that? Because I don't remember it. And so, you know what? I will hold that a greater grudge against that pious horse's ass. Then I will, man, maybe that just marks me as a real bad person.
The only thing that I've come to is that if the Pittsburgh Steelers end up winning the Super Bowl, I'm going to hear it for a lot less time than if the Denver Broncos win the Super Bowl. The Denver Broncos,
oh, there's a lot of...
I will hear that for the next decade.
Absolutely. And I don't think you've got any worries about the Denver Broncos even going to the Super Bowl. You know, there is some scary stuff for this game coming up simply because Pittsburgh is beaten to pieces. They're a mess, and they badly needed a bye week. But no, sorry, that wouldn't happen. The Ravens got that one. But even if they get by, Pittsburgh, then they get the Patriots. And we saw what the Patriots did to him, right? After a while, you just had to turn away.
And that was the Patriots at Denver, you know, in the Mile High Stadium, thin air. If Denver wins, are they playing the Patriots at their place?
Oh, if Denver beats Pittsburgh, they go on the road to Foxborough.
Oh, yeah, still, yeah, definitely not going to happen then.
Right. And, yeah, I'm getting a little backup here, Paul. Our buddy Marty says, easy question to answer. I hate Jesus H. Tebow more than I'll ever hate Roethlisberger.
Well, it's the Seahawks fan in me. When I was at that Super Bowl party, and I've never heard such loud profanity in my life. I'm from Seattle. You pretty much could hear it scream all over the place.
you could probably hear it in Spokane.
Yeah.
So
anyway, to really shift into what I wanted to call about is that late last week, early this week, you and Jim were talking about the viral, the paper on the virus, the flu virus that had been mutated.
Mm-hmm.
But I dropped my 2 cents, you know, mad chemist, you know, virology, immunology class into it.
Please.
And try to just explain that. If this was being used for weapon development, the virus, it would be done by the DOD. It wouldn't be publicly funded by the NIH and such. So there wouldn't need to be a story. There wouldn't be a question of please don't print this, because it would be locked in a secret, top secret government vault, classified and everything.
Very, very solid observation. Yes.
The reason that you do stuff like this is I haven't read the paper or the data on the paper, but I talked to someone who did. And basically the difference between this airborne flu they made and the natural occurring flu is out there is 5 amino acid codes. So just it changed in 5 places on the amino acid on one of the genes, and that made it airborne. And the reason that's important is that it gives you a huge insight into, you know, what changes, what protein, you know, changes the virus. And the second thing is that now you know these 5 changes make it airborne. When you're studying the thousands or hundreds of different flu strains that are out every year as they go across, you know, infect the planet, if you see one with, they only choose to give you a flu shot against the strongest, the most virulent, whatever, you know, to protect you. So if you see a naturally occurring flu that say it's got 2, 3, or 4 of these 5 changes in it, you can know that you need to target that flu because it could mutate to the 5th and become airborne and a problem to make a flu shot to protect people against. So it is an important sort of like, you know, counter-preventative research. So if it is mutating in nature that way, you can stop it before it gets there.
Well, and one of the concerns that I mentioned, and our friend Jeanette sort of echoed along the way via an email, is the question of how, you're right, it would be allegedly locked down in a vault somewhere in the DOD if it was being weaponized. But under the circumstances where it exists now, and the research and the literature, is it even possible to keep that secret? For instance, given the propensity of, say, WikiLeaks, who generally believes that everything should be public. How long could this possibly remain hidden or sort of redacted, if you will? And that's not a criticism of WikiLeaks, that's just their philosophy.
I really don't know, to be honest. There's a huge kind of talk about whether the paper should just be published. I've heard many different arguments, one being, you know, the main reason maybe the government, because it would be easy to basically, not easy, but it would be worthwhile to basically, you know, inject this dead flu virus that is airborne into an egg and make a flu shot vaccine. I mean, you know, they can only do so many a year. They can only pack so many in a flu shot. So there's an argument that just says, you know, publish it, make the flu shot, and get on with your lives. And another one that says maybe they don't want it published because maybe there already is a similar virus that has been made 5, 10 years ago that's already locked in top secret DOD vault, and they don't really want an antidote made to their weapon that they made 10 years ago, because that's, you know, however many billion dollars flushed down the drain.
Oh, we just kind of moved over into the real scary part of the conversation, didn't we?
Yeah, and it goes on and on and on. You know, it's hard to say whether to be the main fear of it being publicized so that terrorists can make it into a bioweapon is... I really don't know much about intelligence work and tracking that kind of thing down, but you need certain things to make that happen, to mutate a virus and to store it and everything of that nature. And I'd assume it's a lot like, you know, watching to see if you're building a nuclear weapon. There are certain things on the shopping list, and once those sales are made, you kind of track them back and, hey, this person's assembling all these pieces. Let's go spy on them and see what they're doing. And it also would take a long time to mutate, probably months to a couple of years. So you have time to figure out who's doing what and track them down. So like I said, I don't really know if they should publish it or not. I don't have an opinion. I'm kind of leave that up to brighter minds. But I find the basic, you know, terrorists could use it to kill us. Sort of a not a very good argument to keep it quiet.
Sound reasoning in my book.
Yeah.
I think so, indeed.
And the other thing, just to answer Jim's question, the flu can, viruses and typically can't jump species very well, but the flu can because it's a very inefficient, it's very inefficient. It mutates a lot because it's not very good at copying itself. So it's sort of like a, you know, if you're very good at copying yourself, you never change. So when things change, environments change, you die, whatever life form you are. And if you're way too bad at copying your DNA, you mutate a lot, which means that you're not very good at functioning and doing things well. For example, there's a PFU, which is a virology term for how many particles it takes to infect a cell. And more dangerous diseases like Ebola or Marburg are like 18 to 25 PFUs per one cell, and the flu is 10,000 PFUs to one cell on average.
Wow.
It's very inefficient. And the reason being is that when the flu uses the cell membrane for its packaging. So, like, think of a big circle. When the flu virus packages itself, a little bud appears on the cell and kind of breaks off a little circular piece of the cell and the membrane, the original cell membrane gets smaller. And then the little itty-bitty piece that's now of cell membrane that's encompassing the flu virus is how the flu travels.
Just to be absolutely clear about this, it's inefficiency, as you describe it, Paul, is not necessarily an indicator of virulence.
No, it's just how and why it can jump so often to a species, because the packaging it has eight separate genome lengths pieces to package in that bud when it breaks off, and there's no mechanism for getting all eight pieces. So sometimes it gets 12 pieces, sometimes it gets 4 pieces, and without all eight pieces, it can't infect the cell properly. So that's why it takes so many to infect the cell. But also, different kinds of flu can infect the cell at the same time, and they can trade and swap pieces. So suddenly, you know, you can now have a virus particle that's got protein recognition for duck and pig at the same time because it walloped in 15 or 16 pieces of the genes rather than its standard 8, because it's just sort of a random, crapshoot how many get into the package each time it goes. So that's how they jump species. So Jim is right that viruses don't generally jump species easily, but the flu is the exception, which is why people are so freaked out about it, because it can jump from bird to pig to people relatively easily, because bird flu and human flu can, merge and trade genes and pieces to each other relatively quickly, and then you've got a combined bird-human thing flying, a bird-human flu flying around. So that's just the lesson for the flu for today.
Well, and I'm grateful for it. Well, this is part of what makes this whole process so cool is because it's this open source sort of combination and sharing of information where we get questions answered, and maybe knowledge is power, right? Or at least we hope it is. But
I guess that's what makes us liberal.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the other thing being, I guess a question, could, with the fear that has been manifested over this story and so forth, can there be another flu pandemic like 1918? Or can medical science keep up? Because, I mean, there wasn't even any sort of flu vaccine back then, right?
Right. It's a lot less likely. The WHO and the CDC are eminently professional organizations who never get their funding cut, at least not yet, that I've seen, to monitor.
Well, I do remember when the CDC's traumatic brain injury program got zeroed out under Bush, or at least they sought to. I don't know if that ultimately happened or not, but I remember. That was frightening because that was right in the middle of the war against the people of Iraq that George started, and suddenly they wanted, and maybe that's because it was casting a little too much light on the situation.
I never heard that story, but mostly I just watch their I'm just familiar with their operation and what they do. and the CDC and the WHO constantly look at viruses, you know, the SARS problem back in, what, 02, 01?
Right.
And they look, they constantly look for viruses and bacteria that could cause a problem, and then they just choose to commit their resources to what they consider the most dangerous or the ones that could most likely mutate or spread through a population, concentrated population, to mutate even more, and then they go vaccinate those areas to keep the disease contained.
Okay.
So there's, you know, these are really heads up people. One of the places I'm going to be applying for work after I get done in June is the Wildlife Pathology Lab in Ashland, Oregon, and they do wildlife poaching forensics. So like they are kind of like the CSI of like poaching. So like Africa sends them forensic samples from the process to help catch poachers that like shoot rhinos, but also locally in the National Forest over here, they also track and gather dead animal samples, pathology samples, and analyze them for rabies and bubonic plague, which both still exist, and try and using vaccinations and other means stop those disease animals with that could possibly carry those diseases get into the urban populace, so that you get the less chance of a coyote with rabies coming out of the wild if you live near the woods near your house, and then
right. And one, yeah, I remember one of the things, and I can't remember what the exact name of the disease is, but it wound up being, it's a kissing cousin to mad cow disease, and it runs through the deer and elk population and down into the little
a wasting disease.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember a fella somewhere in Appalachia some years back that died a horrible death because he had a passion for squirrel brains.
Yeah, and he got infected with a prion disease. Yeah, that stuff's not fun. And they try to keep an eye on that too. So I mean, there are people, you know, there are tons of hidden people. I kind of call them I call them garbage men, because you never see the garbage man come pick up your trash either, because it's early in the morning. There are tons of, you know, people that are just taking out the trash of our society, keeping diseases in check and keeping all this other stuff in check, and keeping us, you know, generally safe and healthy, and we never see them.
That's absolutely fascinating, Paul. Thank you very much. I hope you have a great weekend.
Yeah, and enjoy watching the playoffs.
I'm gonna try. You got some amens in here. Jan just wrote in from Vegas. She says, as Seattle born and bred, I too hate the Steelers for being Steelers of the Super Bowl game. I could not root for either of these teams. Let's just see who does worse.
Well, I'm more like rooting to who's going to lose, you know.
Well, I'm sure I'll frustrate somebody. That was what happened to me in the Sugar Bowl, where Virginia Tech was playing Michigan. I would have been happy if the thing could have ended in negative numbers for both squads, because I just despise both teams. I just do. I'm sorry. I'll get mail. But that's how...
Everybody's a fan of some team.
Well, yeah, and I've got this long rivalry thing with Virginia Tech, but the other thing I've got is the whole Rich Rodriguez thing from West Virginia to Michigan, and, of course, they got their comeuppance for doing that anyway, so I guess there is some justice in the universe. Paul, like I said, have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy the game, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Take care now. Bye. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob. How you doing?
Hey, is this Bill?
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay, considering the holidays usually drive me to depression and distraction. But that's what happens, you know.
But they're over mercifully, so...
Yes.
Onward to February.
Yes, yeah, so many of us, the folks... So you've got children yet growing, of course, as they are, and Christmas stays special when you've got family. But all the people that made Christmas for me, they're no longer around, you know. But getting back to Ferg and Agnes, let's hope for the best, because, you know, I'm sure you'll keep on top of that situation.
Yeah, well, right now it's just a matter of the biggest thing is to make sure that they're okay, and that's what all the diagnostic stuff is about. And
well, you know, you've got one hell of a lawsuit there if you want to bother with it.
Well,
from behind is, you know.
Yeah, that establishes liability. Then you have to establish the damages. Or at least that's what they taught me back while I was having those cups of coffee in law school.
And let's hope that You don't have to.
Well, I'd rather there not be any damages, frankly.
The way these insurance companies treat you, though, on a guy got me that way one time, and they wonder why they get sued. They pin you to the wall on the Blue Book value. I bought a truck out of Phoenix in 82, and it was a 72, but it was the bottom was still shiny. And I think I kept it for over 10 years. I put a camper on it, so I had a portable dressing room for a musician. That was a good deal, you know. And I had to call out an appraiser on that truck to get the insurance other than the age of the truck, the condition of the truck, where the appraiser came out and, you know.
Right.
And that's the way you had to do business. But insurance companies, I don't care what they're insuring. A getaway car is more like it with those guys. But then you guys hit football, and Bob, I discovered the game in 54 at age 11, and the Cleveland Browns, there was a team, my friend.
Oh, there's no fan like a Browns fan. And
oh, yeah, and it's because of Paul and Otto Graham and then Jim Brown. My God, you know. It's like hockey's big with me now because I started following the AHL when there was still only six teams in the NHL. So you saw guys playing top minors who, you know, were fine players, so you got into the game quickly. But, the political situation has me really worried. What do you think? Do you think Santorum can continue this mess?
He doesn't. The money bill says that he doesn't have the money.
Yeah.
So in that sense, no, I don't think he can. But then again, if he gets some sort of momentum behind him, it becomes an entirely different ball of wax. Because if people lose confidence in Romney, then and then again, you know, look, you've got a certain amount of weirdness out there, Bill. For instance, this woman who had to run out and apologize real quick because of her comments yesterday. She's State Representative Judy Manning. She's a Republican from Georgia. She said that. She would be troubled to have to vote for a Mormon, but at least Romney's not a Muslim.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So, now, Romney really has a problem in that portion of the country that is supposedly a cakewalk in a presidential election year for anybody with an R behind their name. You know, all the stands, Alabama stand, Mississippi stand, Georgia stand, yeah. All of those are supposed to be easy, but there's not a one of them that's going to be because the people who vote in those primaries are people who spend a lot of time in fundamentalist churches.
Yeah.
And frankly, they would rather vote for a Roman Catholic than a Mormon.
Well, especially that guy, because that was what I was raised in. In fact, I learned in later years that my great-grandfather, who was supposedly an Eastern Orthodox priest, my dad's brother, when I was about 35, he says, Bill, the old man told you that? He says, Bill, your great-grandfather was a Roman Catholic priest in a small mining town in PA, and he married the housekeeper. I said, well, now I understand where my problems came from. You know, where the problems are in your genes, so to speak, the things that are driving.
Well, yeah, you kind of took me aback when you got to my grandfather was a Roman Catholic priest.
Great-grandfather, yeah.
Or great-grandfather, yeah.
Yeah, and my grandfather was born here, and he went back to Austria with the old man and came back at age 11 and was a coal miner around Pittsburgh area somewhere in PA, and then came to Cleveland to work at New York Central. Decided, according to my uncle, he said the old man decided there were safer ways to make a living than mining coal, especially in those days, you know.
Well, in those days and in those parts. So he would have been working in roughly the same geographic area where Grandpa Santorum was working?
Yeah, probably.
Was,
I never learned.
Well, just in, Bill, in trying to sort out some of these questions I've been asking about that little bit of hagiography. Was he able to join a union?
My great-grandfather?
No. Was it your granddad came back from Austria?
Yeah, my grandfather. He was born here, so he was a citizen. Even though their family went back to the old country, he came back at age 11 by himself. Kids were, you know?
Yeah.
That was that whole immigrant era.
Right, so that would be more along the line. That would be more along the lines of the time frame of the Molly Maguires and stuff, then, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I never got to meet him. He died in the 1930s, so I never got to meet my paternal grandfather. My maternal granddad I lived with, so I got to know him real well. And that side of my family, my great grandfather on my mom's side, had fought in two wars for the Kaiser: 64 against Denmark, 66 against Austria. And they were gearing up for the Franco-Prussian exhibition, and he said, "The hell with it." And I was...
Two's enough.
That side of my family was very anti-military, because they had been there, you know?
Right. Well, when you march for the Prussian war machine...
Yep.
Exactly.
So he decided to come here, because the way he put it to my grandfather, who taught me this stuff, was that he basically felt he had used up his... How many are your odds, you know?
Right. No longer willing to play against the law of averages.
Yeah, you can't do it. It's funny. My own birth situation is being born in the middle of World War II. Is like, I think I was on either the cusp or the fault line of this major changes in society. Because, man, in the 60s and 70s, things started rocking. And we thought we had finished the right wing in 1964.
And then we thought we had finished the Republican Party because getting rid of Nixon.
Nixon, yeah. Tricky dicky, yes, sir.
But it turns out they're a little bit like the clap, aren't they?
Yeah, they keep coming back. Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, to me... I wasn't a big Ike fan when I was a kid, but now I look back on a guy, and he was probably the best Republican president of my lifetime, and maybe one of the best in this century, him and T.R.
Right, and recognizing that Teddy Roosevelt, neither Teddy Roosevelt nor Dwight Eisenhower nor Richard Nixon, probably not Gerald Ford, and arguably not Ronald Reagan, would be welcome in the Republican Party today. That point I was making last night. That's not hyperbole. That's the truth.
Yeah, the religious folks have taken it over, and that's been a strong, like you, Bob, I have the same attitude towards the whole racket that you do. It's a good way to make a buck. We had a guy in Cleveland here took over a old movie theater for a while, and the Cleveland Press discovered he was dripping chicken blood on people out of the balcony. There was a hustler. I should be so good. Yeah, his name was R.L. Stiles, and that was running in the newspaper when I was young enough to
dripping chicken blood.
Yeah, yeah.
See, this is the downside of Friday on the Front Porch, because, I mean, that's just straight to the bottle for me, dripping chicken blood.
Well, good. Whatever works. I wish... Tell me something that'll work for me, man. I quit drinking. I got a bottle of Daniels that I bought in 2002 and still haven't opened, so...
Well, I know more than... I know there's a lot of... more than a few people in the Horn family who would be more than happy to help you open that.
Well, I'll tell you, the right person to sit on and BS with, I'd have a few. Because I never had a real, I could put away a half a fifth a night of gin when I was working music. Because the people in the audience, you're a blues musician, drink.
Yes.
You know, they expected it of you. So we did.
Occupational hazard.
Yes. Well, that was what ruined my first marriage, was the being on the, in the area of the sexual revolution. Bob, I was a true patriot in that one. I fought for that one. You know how it is. It's all dependent on who you are as a person. And man, oh man, I mean, I talk to these young kids today, and they think I'm lying.
Oh, no, you're not.
I know.
No, not in that era. Oh, no.
Well, and I look at this.
But I don't want to just put too much of a line of demarcation between young and old, or this generation and that generation, but there was no AIDS, there was no HIV, no herpes to worry about.
If you weren't allergic to penicillin, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And it, I did get one minor thing that that's referred to as the butterflies of love, and it was a police inspector's daughter that passed that one.
God, Bill.
Bob, the time and place was just insane in so many ways, and it's insane today, but it's so negative. I mean, that was just, yeah, we had our, the anti-war demonstrations, took part in a few of those, and but I'd argue with people about it. I'd say, look, I'm against it because there's nothing to win there. There's no reason for this crap. There's nothing for the American people there. Morality is, basically, you're right on with morality, but the reality is that there's, what is there? Why are we there? Show me a reason that it would do any good. I mean, somebody had to go up against Adolf, and thank God for the Russians. God, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't use that term. But that's something for those guys, because they, in 43, when the Americans and the British landed in Sicily, the Russians were tying up about 175 German divisions in Russia. That's a lot of manpower.
It is indeed.
But, I don't know what we go, where we go from here. It's just my citizens, my fellow citizens. I got a buddy taught history for 45 years in high school. He said it deteriorated to crap as he was teaching. The rules and the rubrics and the books and things just disappeared.
Well, I had a story out of New Hampshire. A couple of nights ago we had the story about how all laws citing individual freedoms will now have to, if the Republicans get their way, would have to cite to the Magna Carta.
Yes.
Well, there was another story where the Republicans have introduced a curriculum optional bill in the state legislature there.
Brother.
Curriculum optional? I mean, I'm not kidding. That's what it said.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling. But then again, there's a real urge inside a significant portion of the political elite on the right wing that believes that stupid is good because they struggle, they fail, and maybe they show up to vote, and if they show up to vote and you've told them that Jesus depends on it, then they'll vote your way even though you're the one who's screwing.
Yeah.
And you can, and that describes a significant part of the geography of this entire country.
Yeah, it's all over the place. In my area of the world, a lot of the immigrants came in and brought a lot of their European prejudices and hatreds with them. A buddy of mine's mother, her family was from a little country in the Balkans, which isn't even a country, and she married an Italian guy. And he says that side of his family still holds it against his father. He wasn't from the same group as them.
Oh, Boss Man Wayne could tell you a story like that, too. He's told me, and it's mind-boggling, because that's never something that I was familiar with. I grew up in the South, where the hatreds were a little bit more pronounced and a little bit more wide open and observable, I guess. Bill, it's good talking to you, my friend.
Take care of yourself, man, and let's hope that things work out for you.
Indeed. That's all I'm doing.
With one line, you were talking shoes, man. You were a teenager in the 50s. You didn't wear nothing but Stetsons or Florsheims. If you had to go out and practically get pop bottles to raise the money.
My dad raised me on Florsheims, Bill.
Yes, sir. Okay.
And I saw a pair in the shoe store the other day. You don't want to know where they're made.
Well, they're made in India now. I got a couple pairs, but they're, the best ones were $100 boots. But the first thing you had to learn there was from somebody that had a brother and somebody in service, you learned how to wet shine those babies. Anyway, you take care, man.
All right. You have yourself a great weekend, Bill.
Take care.
We'll talk soon. Bye now. Bill calling from Cleveland. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello. Bob, how you doing?
Oh, good, Andy. How you doing?
All right. Hey, that Santorum piece was too much.
Was it Shameless, for starters?
I'll bet you he's not very happy about that hitting the front page today.
probably not. But the funny thing, you know, why not just report this stuff? Why do you have to go and get the the line of BS from the head of PR for Consol? Am I missing something here? You read the article, Andy. Was there anything? Did that look journalistically necessary?
Well, you know, you're just going to get BS from the representative from the corporation, the PR person.
Right. So why bother?
Crap. Why even ask?
I mean, just
right. Well,
if it's a fact, report the facts, because that's one of the things that struck me as I read it. Is, I mean, granted, I was glad to have her smarminess to allude to in the course of talking about the article, but what in that quote from the PR flack for Consol fills either the who, what, when, where, why, or how of any good journalistic attempt?
You know, they're just going to say something as positive as Peach about Consol and Rick Santorum, you know, and that's what she did.
Right. I mean,
that's what they're paid to do. That's her job. She's a paid, you know, Edward L. Bernay, paid propagandist.
Right, and as we, you know, as we look at the 4%, the 1% for profit media, that was almost the 4% one profit media. No, but as we look at the 1% for profit media, isn't that just about the same thing as product placement in a movie? Because that was the way it struck me.
Well, if you get them front page coverage, you don't get that every day for free. It's kind of nice, huh?
Right, and I guess she walked back into the office and said, "Look, boss, there's no such thing as bad PR, unless the mine, you know, unless the mine blows up." But that couldn't, yeah, that didn't hurt him. Gosh, they were just helping out somebody who helped out. They were just being neighborly, weren't they, Andy?
Of course, you know, they're just helping out the political system. I mean, that's just the way politics work.
Yeah, and by the way, I mentioned who, what, when, where.
We're putting the lights on, just like you see on the billboards. We put the light. We're giving cheap energy to the people of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, giving it. I guess the New York...
giving it away.
They've got too much. The New York Times didn't ask anybody in southwest Pennsylvania what the power bill's looking like these days. I get no.
You know, they probably didn't have the time to do that kind of work.
But I'm not I'm not getting any of that cheap energy either, even though they keep telling me that. The bills just keep going up and up and up. I think 150% in rate increases over the last 4 to 5 years. Yeah, that's some cheap coal.
Yeah, and a lot of that's due to, at least on the fossil fuel oil side, a lot of it's due to speculation. And, of course, a lot on the coal side is due to the competition you're getting from shipping it overseas. But those prices are, a lot of it's, you know, the Wall Street and the Commodities Future Exchange, the bidding that's going on there and the speculation, just driving it up. And the oil company execs have come out and said 40% of the price of oil and gas, heating oil and gas for your car, is speculation. Period. There's so many speculators, so many hedge funds doing speculation, and then you got the big three or four on Wall Street, Goldman, Morgan, and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan and whoever else is left there. There's some.
Yeah, just we can just say the Predators.
Citigroup would be another big trading house. I mean, they're the ones bidding it up.
Well, see, and with...
Yeah, the bidding up of that is done there. That's the baloney of Obama and this administration being in bed with Wall Street, letting them do any of the crap they want to do. I mean, speculation in those kind of commodities should just be outlawed. Can't do it because it affects consumers and older people that need to buy that stuff to keep themselves alive, keep their homes. And to get transportation, it should be just outlawed. No speculation on certain commodities, period. And
like foodstuffs?
Yeah. Not that hard to do. Exactly. Let's just let the farmers do it. The people that really need it, like we've talked about before, the people that are really hedging their bets, that are going to buy or sell product, are going to deliver product or take delivery. They're the only people that can do it. End of story. That's the way it should be. But, you know, that's not going to happen with Wall Street owning both political parties.
No, not likely. And what I find interesting is the hissy, you know, with the so-called recess appointment of Cordray. The Republicans...
Oh, that should have been done a long time ago.
Yeah, but it's unconstitutional. That we were in session, damn it!
Yeah, here we go.
But of course...
Here we go. That's a good use of their time.
Right. But of course, it was okay, you know, never was heard a discouraging word when George W. Bush was doing it left and right. Again, it's about the hypocrisy in the long run, right?
And what did he do it three times as many times as Obama has up to this point in his presidency, something like that?
Right.
Three times the amount of people were given recess appointments. That's a joke. The only thing you can say to the Republicans is, goddamn, they go to bat for their constituents, which are the big 1% corporations. They do go to bat for them.
Yeah, I mean,
think about that.
The people,
everything, they'll pull out every stop.
The people who buy them get their money's worth.
Yes, that's true. It's a good dollar spent. Just like Kazantorum. Yeah, that Universal Health Services, that was probably a good dollar spent. They didn't go into how much money Universal Health got off the Medicare uplift, the rise in spending, and the Puerto Rican hospitals that they had. But I'll bet you it more than... you know, 10 or 20-fold, if not more, 100 times paid for.
Well, we know what they paid him for.
Put him on the board.
They paid him $395,000.
Right.
If
they had to fill that board seat anyway, you might as well give it to somebody that's giving back to you.
Yeah.
And you know he's a hack, and he'll do anything you want him to do. Just a complete hack. He would never question management for a second. That's what's, of course, so wrong about the whole corporate board structure, period. They're just hacks.
And that's why I'm kind of impressed with this benefit corporation the story.
Patagonia, yeah. Patagonia's a great company. I agree with you. I buy a lot of their stuff when I can. It's great stuff too.
And it lasts and lasts and lasts. I see.
You got it.
I see a lot of the younger folks in the struggle to end mountaintop removal, and they're wearing the stuff, and they. And it's not like they've got, you know, it's not like they go out and buy the whatever collection of Patagonia. They got a couple of pieces, and they wear forever.
Right. Yeah, it's good.
It would be nice if they could take the next step and say, we're going to make our stuff here. And maybe that's what happens under this benefit corporation structure.
Hopefully.
Because if it precludes shareholder suits for not being profiteering enough, then maybe you can bring some of your manufacturing back to the United States. Because then the shareholders can't say, no, we want to pay some little Chinese child 5 cents an hour, and what about our share price? So I
think actually most of their stuff is in South America, but that's actually put together. But like you said, the stuff lasts a long time. You're going to pay more, but it lasts a long time. You do pay for it.
Yeah, I think the cheapest thing I've seen there is like $60.
Yeah.
But let's see. I just happened to call it up real quick just to get a country of origin idea. Let's look at it.
I was thinking it's usually South American countries. They do a lot of their work, and they seem to be into the South Americans. You know, thinking Colombia or Honduras or something like that.
Yeah, that Central America is big. Thailand. Here's a hoodie from Thailand.
I always hate to see that, but
At least they tell you. I mean, this is a website. They don't have to tell you, but they tell you.
Yeah.
Here's a rain jacket from Vietnam. So they're getting it from all over, but again, if we really want to see jobs come back to the United States, and they you know, now that they have become this kind of corporate structure, then bring consumer pressure to bear and say, make it in the United States. And they can respond to that.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, it works.
No problem here.
Yeah.
Next time I talk to them, I'll let them know.
Right, and again, they do, and I imagine given their commitment to environmental principles and so forth, they probably do at least have a corporate culture of trying to ensure some sort of decent compliance with manufacturing standards. But, you know, I was thinking about manufacturing today, Andy, because those manufacturing numbers came out. And granted, it was no reason to fire up Happy Days or Here Again or anything. But it's a net gain in the manufacturing sector, which God knows this country desperately needs. But the question is the quality of the jobs. Because did you see that story a few days back? That yes, manufacturing jobs are coming back to the United States, but they're coming back to the United States at insanely low pay.
Right, you can work for $12 an hour while your colleague in Germany is doing the same work for $66 an hour. It's
right.
A wonderful thing.
And it'll be a cold day in hell when they let those wages catch up to the German ones.
Right.
Yeah, 23,000 manufacturing jobs were added in December, Andy.
So are you talking about ISM numbers? This supply management numbers came in?
I don't know. I'm looking at...
With the 200,000 jobs and manufacturing... did increase like 20,000 or something, I think.
This is a press release from the Alliance for American Manufacturing, a good organization, based upon the announcement from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
All right, so they're quoting the unemployment. Yeah, the unemployment number, the 200,000 jobs were added in non-farm payroll, and I believe 20,000 of that was in manufacturing. I think the healthcare industry was strong, and so was education. Came in high, and of course, government actually was a negative again. I think that knocked off like 13,000 or 15,000 jobs or something.
Right.
You can thank the Republicans for that. The son of a bees.
Well, they're not going to. And it does. If it was 200,000 manufacturing jobs, they would have some sort of an excuse. And I've got a perfect example of that. We've been talking about Rick Santorum, right? Well,
yeah.
you know what? I mean, this guy is a sick loon. If he was just a little bit older, he'd be...
Look at his face, man.
Yeah.
Look at that smirk, son of a B. He's got the world by the damn balls, he thinks.
Well,
the way he looks, you know.
Well, check this quote.
Yeah.
Check this quote out.
I'm a star.
Yeah. Check this quote out. I'm very gratified to see that in spite of President Obama's policies, the job market is beginning to pick up a little bit. I think there might just be some optimism that maybe Republicans are going to take the White House. Maybe that's spurring people to take some risks. I'll take that as a reason.
Yeah, there's a little Edward L. Bernays spin for you right there. Take a bit of news that's really bad for the Republican Party and spin it and make it into something positive for them. Right. Unfortunately, they're going to need a lot more jobs than just 200,000 a month to really get people back employed. And unfortunately, I think there's so many people that are just rolling off the unemployment lines because their unemployment insurance is just running out. It's reason the number went down to 8.5% to the rate, you know, a slight drop.
Because of people falling off the list as well?
Yeah, I think that's the major reason it's been proven. Because 200,000 jobs just isn't really enough to put much of a dent when you got 15 million people looking for work. It's not putting much of a dent there. Anyway, too, you see the front page of the New York Times, an article about one of my favorite senators when I lived back east, Robert Menendez.
No, I don't think I saw that.
More money. Yeah, he's on the front page, too, with the Santorum article. He's actually holding up a judicial appointment. Because the woman's boyfriend was one of the people under Chris Christie, who used to be the Attorney General of New Jersey, was investigating Mr. Menendez. Because he had a little deal where it's a nonprofit organization that he was propping up through Congress, getting them funds, were actually paying him for a rental property that he owned. Kind of nice. Feed the nonprofit group with government money, and then they pay him for a rental property. Kind of a neat deal.
You know, one of those pro-coal blue dog Democrats from, I think, what is West Virginia's first district, his name was Alan Mollahan, and he'd been in Congress since God was a baby. He lost to a teabagger in the 2010 cycle because they made so much hay out of the fact that he was funneling money to a nonprofit that his pals owned.
Menendez is known for being the number one hedge fund contribution guy. He takes more money from New York Wall Street hedge funds than anybody. That's why you will never see legislation get by him that's going to possibly tax the hedge fund managers above the capital gains 15% rate. Nope, not going to happen. Not with Robert Menendez, their man in there. He's just a Wall Street scumbag. And that's end of story. No matter what people ever say anything good about Menendez, you ought to have your head examined, because he's a crony, he's a crook.
There's a certain amount of proof in the fact that, especially in this era, having the D behind your name is no guarantee of future results.
Doesn't mean anything. You know, you were talking about what's his name out there in Nebraska, Ben Nelson.
Yeah.
In his war chest. It's probably going to get unloaded on some progressive sometime down the road. You're going to see some progressive coming up and making a stand against some of Rahm Emanuel DLC hack. And that's where you're going to see that war chest be unloaded that Ben Nelson has. They'll hold it till somebody good comes up for us, and that's where it'll go. Do you ever hear of a guy named The Torch?
No.
The Torch. Rick Torricelli.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah.
2002. This guy was even worse than Robert Menendez, if you can believe it. This guy was another crook, another criminal, part of the mafia in New Jersey, right? Rick Torricelli got drummed out of the Senate. Now, you know, you really got to do something bad to get drummed out of that exclusive club.
That's true. It's coming back to me now, yeah.
Right. All right, so Mr. Torricelli, again, was one of these guys that had a huge war chest from all the mafia in New Jersey that fed him with cash, right? You know where that war chest went, Bob?
No.
I'll tell you where it went. When Howard Dean was running in 2004, all of a sudden a whole bunch of ads started coming out of the woodwork against Mr. Dean in the media of Iowa. It came from Rich Torricelli's war chest. Rahm Emanuel gave him the green light. Unload that money, Rick, and we'll give you a good job back in New Jersey, which they did. He worked for a county Democratic Party somewhere with all the same benefits and about the same money he made working for the Senate. They took care of him. But that's where Rick Torricelli, that's got to stop, that baloney where they keep that war chest and then they're allowed to just dump it at will.
Well, I mean, and I guess the question, I agree with you, the question is, where do you make them put it? Where do you make it? Do you just say give it to a charity?
The general party or something, like, right? Or charity or the general party funds. Not to be targeted for the use of, you know, some devil like Rahm Emanuel so they could take out a progressive. But that's where Torricelli's money went. He used it in Iowa. That's documented.
Well, and there's another story out there. David in Tennessee sent me one earlier today about the governor of Kentucky by the name of Steve Beshears. Now, it turns out, and what David said is, Beshears' inaugural fund has inaugural fund, okay? This is because, you know, you go out and solicit private donations for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Beshears' inaugural fund has $500,000 left after paying bills, and the Republic reports that it's unclear what will become of the money. And David noted, after they've paid for a big-ass gala, you know, the kind, the ones with shrimp the size of Santa Ana peppers, there's 500 large just laying around. And David asked, you reckon one of those dirt-poor eastern Kentucky counties could do some good with 500 large of coal operators' money? damn straight.
Yeah.
But it'll
go. It's going to be used to clean up or education or health care or something, but no. It just goes to this top 1% baloney. And people wonder why we have the Occupy movement. You know, I had a woman confront me at my DFA meeting the other night because I told her I had shut down two ports and two banks here locally. She goes, why are you doing that? You're stopping people from working. You have to stop doing that.
Oh, God.
I looked at her and I went, what world are you in? The only thing they listen to is when you hit them in the pocketbook. When you stop the money coming in, they listen. Don't you get it? One of these people, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't strike. You shouldn't shut down the ports like that. Oh, Bob, I got so mad. I couldn't believe it. I was like, Jesus Christ, what world? You're not in my world, honey. But there are people out there that say, oh, no, don't do that. Don't upset the workers. You got to let them work. Oh, Jesus.
Oh, and let me share a detail with you out of this Kentucky Steve Beshear story, because this is a real screamer. There are no limits. I mean, you talk about dirty politics. There are no limits on how much a person give to an inaugural committee. All right.
Right.
So there's a town in eastern Kentucky. I've been there. It's called Inez. One of the great heroes of the efforts to in this struggle to end mountaintop removal, a good friend of ours by the name of Mickey McCoy is from Inez, Martin County, Kentucky, where a mountain blew out and sent millions of gallons of sludge all over Martin County back in 2001.
An act of God, Bob. That's an act of God.
That's some God.
You know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So James Booth owns Booth Energy. He gave $100,000 to Beshear's inaugural fund. So then there's also a cat by the name of James C. Justice II, otherwise known as Jim Justice. He's from Beaver, West Virginia. Not Beaver, Kentucky. Beaver, West Virginia. And he's a coal thug. He's the same guy who bought the Greenbrier Resort with the money he got from selling some of his coal operations to the Russians.
Wow.
He ponied up 25 large, and then three other members of his immediate family also ponied up 25 large. So there's $100,000 from the Justice family, irony department, notice.
Real justice.
Right. And then there's O. Bruton Smith of Charlotte, North Carolina, who owns Speedway Motorsports, which owns the Kentucky Speedway in Sparta, Kentucky. He gave $50,000. Now, do you do that, Andy, just because you like a good party? Just because you really like those really great big daggum shrimp? Or do you do that because you're buying something, especially if you're from North Carolina or West Virginia?
Crawling in the chips. Money talks, BS walks. That's the way it is. You want to play the game, you better pay up, son. It's time to pay up. They'll get the quid pro quo down the road. You know that.
Oh, sure, because I know both Booth and Justice are friends of coal. And, you know, if you live in Kentucky now, you can get yourself a friends of coal license plate.
Well, that's why we have Occupy, man. You know, these guys get taken care of. Everybody gets taken care of on the Republican side. And a lot of us are getting just sick of it. And it's getting to the point of no return, you know? I mean, this is so unfair. The system has become so unfair and so crooked and so corrupt that money, and then you say this all the time, and I know I'm preaching to the choir with a lot of the horn audience, man, money is just drives everything. Nothing else matters but the money. Nothing else. Nothing. You know, having a good life, doing decent things, just having a high quality of life, just looking out for the environment for 7 years like the Indians used to do, taking care of your environment and being a good steward, you know, that means nothing to these people.
Oh, no. Lives
satisfaction they get, the immediate satisfaction of that incessant greed, you know?
Live simply so that others may simply live is something approaching heresy to them.
Right.
Astonishing. It is.
Yeah. And you know, too, you were talking to, I think Jim about, it might have been somebody else, that you're talking to about Joseph Goebbels being the model for the different
propaganda
that goes on. You know, he learned everything from Edward L. Bernay. That's why I keep saying Bernay. It was Edward L. Bernay of World War One fame, you know, working for...
was he the one who was the grandson of Freud or something, or the nephew of Freud?
Yeah, exactly. He was trained at Cornell University, but he actually was an Austrian immigrant. But he went to Cornell. He had an Ivy League degree, and he actually, I think he got his degree in agriculture or something like that, but he got to Washington or something and made some kind of switch.
Well,
the
light went on.
War effort. Right. And the main thing was to crush the unions and crush the trade union, the communists, around that time for Woodrow Wilson, because, of course, he was having a lot of problems with the trade unionists were not in line. The Wobblies and people like that were just not so keen about going to war for the top 1%.
Right. And if ever there was one, that was a 1% war if there ever was one.
Right.
And that, you know, that's why every November 11th I suggest that we might ought to remember. I mean, in the United States, you can get a lot more people worked up about the Civil War than you can about the First World War. And
right.
I think we would do well to pay a little more attention to what went down beginning in August 1914. Isn't it hard to fathom that we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of that abattoir?
Right. I guess just recently all the veterans are dead now, I guess, aren't they?
Yeah, it was just a few months ago that the very last one died.
Right.
So that means we don't even have to think about it anymore.
Now, out of sight, out of mind, when these people go away, you know, the people that actually lived it, it just doesn't have the same wallop.
Yeah, and once
when they were around to talk about it.
And once the knowledge and once the history and the scholarship of it have sort of faded away, then the people on the right wing who just invent history can start talking about, they can start making stuff up about it that they make up about Abraham Lincoln, that they make up about George Washington, that they make up about Thomas Jefferson.
Which they do.
The whole point.
You know, on the BBC the other day, I almost died when I heard they had Michelle Bachmann's campaign manager on it. And this woman is as loony as she is, believe it or not. I know it's hard to believe that somebody can be loonier than Michelle Bachmann, but this woman was. And she made this statement. I couldn't freaking believe it, that the guy from the BBC did. Oh, she goes, our Constitution has been in place since, 1787, and we haven't changed it. And we're not like Europe, like you Europeans. We never fight over it.
You're kidding.
We have not had any fight. I'm thinking, Civil War. Hey, Civil War.
Nah, it's just a little dust up.
And no, she went right through. We've never fought. We all believed in it. We got rid of slavery. She said the same thing Bachmann said. They think we got rid of slavery in 1787 or something like that.
Well, maybe that's a little bit.
She doesn't get corrected.
Maybe that's a little bit of forensics there, Andy, because maybe that explains where that craziness comes from. Maybe she's the one who was feeding Bachmann all that loopy crap.
Could be. But she's like, oh, we never fought over our Constitution. We didn't have the wars like you do in Europe. You're always fighting. Civil War, honey. Civil War. Do you remember? Yeah. I don't know. I had that blasted when my grandparents were around. They used to talk about the Civil War all the time because I had a relative that fought in it. And we still had the coins that he used to carry with him that they say from the Civil War era and stuff. So I had that all the time when I was a kid, just drummed into me. My grandfather could tell me he remembered his grandfather marching as a veteran in the Civil War parade in 1910 or something like that. He still remembered that as a kid. But that didn't happen. to the Bachmans, you know?
No, no.
And this,
well,
this
frankly,
thing.
They may not have even been here by then.
The Gulf of Hormuz thing, too, I know you've been talking about that a little, I think, with Jim. And, you know, I read an article that only 1/6 of the world's oil actually travels through there. That would be only, like, 16% of all the oil. And I know, I think Jim was saying 30%, which, as a matter of fact, I have seen other articles that mention 30%. I mean, what is it really? Is it really that high when I... See, the Financial Times says only 1/6 of all the world's oil. If it's only 1/6,
and see, that's part of the whole sham. It's part of the whole sham that surrounds all of the stuff with Gulf Oil, the geographic location, not the former corporation. We get an infinitesimally small. Maybe that's where the 1/6 comes from, Andy. We get a relatively small amount of what comes into the United States from the Persian Gulf. The vast majority of the foreign oil that the demagogues are constantly prattling on about is foreign oil that comes from those...
Venezuela,
Mexico, and Canada.
Right. It's the closest oil-producing countries to get it from.
I mean, if you want to talk about market economics, that only makes sense, right?
Yeah. And we're now a net exporter of refined petroleum products.
Oh, what happened to that right-wing argument that, them regulations are keeping America from being able to refine enough oil? We ain't been a new gasoline refinery built in 100 years. Remember that one? That's a real greatest hit from, the likes of that drug-addled gas bag.
Right. They're cranking out oil like crazy. And you know the number one state cranking out the oil, this fracking shale, is friggin' North Dakota. They're going bonkers trying to get people to work up there, to work in the oil fields, the fracking. And did you see what Sarkozy of France said the other day?
No, what?
You know they banned fracking in France, and he made a statement, we will never do that kind of drilling here. We're not going to destroy our environment. I mean, he's a right-of-center leader. We're never going to do that kind of drilling here. We're not stupid. We've got the Americans. And then he actually commented about, you can do that in America. Yeah, and he told the French oil company Total, yeah, do all the investments in America for the fracking. They'll let you do it, but you're not going to dig one friggin' drill hole here. Forget it. You're not going to destroy our environment. We have
and again,
we want it to last. But
right.
America, that's fine.
It almost reminds you of the statement made in The Godfather about, let them destroy themselves. They have no souls.
Right.
But,
and you asked me the last time we talked, too, about Corzine and whether I thought he should go to jail. Oh, yeah, I think he should go to jail. God darn, they should have an investigation of him. He's in charge. He runs the company. His company lost people's money. That's causing a lot of misery for a lot of small farmers. Of course there should be an investigation and a judgment on whether he should go to jail. God darn, if he wasn't Obama's largest bundler, largest campaign funder, you know there would be more uproar about that from that administration. God darn, if it was a Republican of some sort, you know, Eric Holder would be right on top of that for the pomp and circumstance of it all.
Oh, no doubt about it.
Caught dead to rights. God, after we have a huge crash on Wall Street, and a couple years later, bingo, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. These potentates do whatever they want, make their own private bets, bring down huge companies that have been in business for, 50, 60, 70 years, I think that company's been in business for, something like that, and he brought it down. And here he is, Obama's biggest campaign contributor, bundler. Beautiful. Nothing's changed. Yeah, he should go to jail.
Well, you'd like to hope that there's an investigation out there. Well, thank you. And Andy, have yourself a great weekend, my friend.
All right, Bob. Thanks for the time.
My pleasure. Take care.
Great job with the Times article today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Andy calling from California. And we go onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Happy Friday, Bob.
Well, happy Friday, Tracy.
How you doing, honey?
Pretty good. Are you driving tonight or this afternoon?
Well, it is actually, it's 5:30, and I'm stuck in the 405 southbound.
Well, as soon as I said, are you driving, I should have said, are you parked on a highway somewhere, because I realized what time it is in L.A.
Well, I am now parked on the 405, on the happiest place on the earth. So it's so funny when you ended the show yesterday about, you know, the San Bernardino assemblyman or whatever that forgot that he had a loaded gun.
Yeah, just forgot he had. And for those who are not gun conversant, Tracy, I probably should have mentioned that a Colt semi-automatic 45 caliber handgun is a great damn big piece of iron. That's a model 1911.
It's not like a 22 or one of those itty-bitty guns.
No, it's not one of those little derringers that a lady of a certain persuasion could tuck in her garter there to the dance hall. No. No.
No. No. No. And so, because, of course, since he's from San Bernardino, you know, of course, and that was something I was going to mention yesterday, and I totally forgot. And then you mentioned it, and I'm crying. Because I'm like, you know, I'm sitting there listening to the news. Actually, I heard the story right before I talked to you yesterday afternoon. And I'm not gun conversant in any shape, form, or fashion. How for never, I've watched TV, and I know what a Colt looks like. It's a big freaking gun, dude. Seriously? First of all, why are you carrying around a loaded gun anyway?
Well, it's because he's had death threats after he said that them Mexicans shouldn't be able to apply for student loan benefits and grants and stuff. Because, you know, them Mexican college students, there's a violent lot, Tracy.
They're a violent bunch, yes. Because, you know, the only thing they care about is, you know, because, you know they're really actually undercover members of the drug cartel. So what they're going to do is, once they get, you know, get an education and gain their citizenship or whatever, they're going to be, you know, able to bring more drug over, you know, they're going to be able to, you know, legalize, not so much get drug legalized, but put a legal face to the drug movement in here, in California. No?
Yeah. And in terms of mean-ass, crazy right-wing Republicans getting in trouble, you know, just being them, it's kind of fun because we've got a from sea to shining sea moment, Tracy, because out there we've got teabagger, gun, briefcase, go to the airport. Well, we can cross the continent to lovely Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Okay.
What hijinks and shenanigans are going on over there?
Well, in Myrtle Beach, you've got Representative Thad Vyers, or maybe it's Veers. It's Thad, T-H-A-D, V-I-E-R-S, and he is a 29-year-old repig-licking, and he's currently representing South Carolina District 68 in the legislature.
No.
But he was going to run for the new congressional seat done opened up in South Carolina.
Okay.
Only problem is he done been arrested.
Oh my.
Yeah, he was dating a young lady.
And how old was the young lady?
Well, the report is not clear.
Uh-oh.
But on December the 16th, 2011, the Myrtle Beach Police Department had to tell Thad Vias to quit having contact with the lady, and he said he would. And at that time, the lady provided the officers with a 3-ring binder completely full up with instances of him harassing her.
Mm.
But he didn't stop harassing, so they done arrested him.
Mm.
And of course, you know, he's a family values Republican, and right. Therefore, well, what applies to you and me don't apply to him, because he used to be 29. He's not 29 anymore. He was 29 in 2007, so 7, 5. Yeah, so now he's like 33 years old. But back when he was a 29-year-old repig-licking, he couldn't resist making threatening phone calls to a fellow by the name of James Ziegler, who was dating his estranged wife, who I guess became his divorced wife. Never mind them family values. But after he got arrested, he issued the following statement, Tracy, and you're going to love this.
Can you please give me the statement?
As of today,
I'm withdrawing from the race for South Carolina's new 7th Congressional District due to personal reasons, and I will not be a candidate for any office in 2012. While I had hoped to join South Carolina's conservative congressional delegation in fighting back against Washington's out-of-control spending spree, now is not the time. Instead, I will focus on building my law practice and advocating free market principles here in Horry County.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in there about I will be
arrested.
Cooling my ass in the stir for a while.
Stupid ass. It's the audacity, the hubris, the... there's so many adjectives, and unfortunately, I wish I had a stronger vocabulary. It's just can a lot of folks be uppity?
Well, and some of it's about the stupid, too. And that's the kind of stupid that you have to spell with two O's and no U. S-T-O-O-P-I-D, stupid.
It's like what I call SOS moment, stuck on stupid.
Yeah, oh yeah. And by the way, with regard to our buddy there on the left coast, Jan just wrote in from Vegas, and she said, "You know, I'm not against the right to own a gun, but
I have no problem.
If you forget you are packing heat, you should not be allowed to carry the dang thing. You at this point are way too dangerous." And I would add as a postscript to what Jan said, and way too stupid.
Because, like you said, it's not like it was in his packed luggage where it was going to be checked, okay? No, it's in your carry-on. I know, because I'm a girl, and on occasion, I carry a purse. And I can always tell when it's not in my purse because of the weight of my purse.
It changes dramatically, doesn't it?
So if I forget my wallet or my keys or what have you, I know. That this lot is either lighter or heavier or whatever the case may be than what it should be. So this was a carry-on piece of, luggage. So typically, especially since you have a limited, the liquids that you can carry on luggage and stuff, and this is a guy. So it's not like men travel with a whole lot of country, unless you're a black man and you need a little bit more oil because our skin gets a little, white folks' skin. So we have the ash factor, However, I cannot understand how you don't know. Because my thing is now when Snoop Dogg or any other rapper who was stupid enough to bring a gun through security and all that, didn't they get arrested on the spot?
No questions asked. Go directly to jail. Do not pass go. And the rest of that.
Chuckle. I forgot that I have my gun and all that and slap on the wrist and, we're sorry, assemblyman or what have you. Don't worry about this. Like, it's like, really? Seriously? How do you not know that you're carrying my automatic weapon in your bag? Again, like I said, I have no issues. I know how to use a gun. I just don't. Okay? I have no problems with the right to bear arms. I have no issues with that at all.
No, but as someone who drives a cab, you're probably better off without one. Because they can be used against you if taken from you.
Exactly. And bottom line is, I'm a girl. I'm a tough girl, but I'm still, bottom line, I'm a female. So it's very much easy for a man to overpower me if he wanted to. And like you said, and then you turn around and use that gun on my happy black ass. But at that point, I would be my unhappy black ass. But it's like, seriously, and temper is so horrible, Bob, that the city, streets of Los Angeles would be riddled with bodies because people drive me crazy. So consequently, I do not have a gun, even though people. My friends and family have wanted me to carry a gun since I've been driving a cab. And, it's only by the grace of God that nothing's ever happened to me. And like I said, I don't live in the fear that something's going to happen to me. I can't live that way, because if I lived that way, I would never get anything done. So I don't think about it. You know, I've been in some sticky situations, but like I said, I'm still here. So now we got that. So, you know, obviously you've heard all the craziness that's been going on in California between the they're trying to fight the DREAM Act here, and our friend, the guy that set the fires all over the place.
Yeah, that guy.
So one of the fires was like two apartments down from me.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he hit the East Valley, which is basically Sherman Oaks. It was like within a 30-minute time period, like six fires, which is around my neighborhood.
Wow. Well, while I do have you, can we go ahead and do our disgustingly stupid right-wing white supremacist racist story of the night?
Okay, please, yay!
Tonight, Tracy, we get to go to Kansas.
What's happening in Kansas, Brother Bob?
I don't think Dorothy is there anymore, or Toto too.
Toto.
No, they've been replaced by a cat by the name of Mike O'Neill. He's a pig licking, of course.
Right, of course.
And he's a fun guy, Mike O'Neill. He just loves a good joke, and he likes to send the jokes around in the email, you know, on the interweb.
Like the lady that was the Republican National, you know, mini person that sends a picture of President Obama being a monkey, and the caption that read, "What? See why there's no birth certificate?"
Right.
Okay.
So the Lawrence Journal World reported on this story.
Mm-hmm.
And the email that fun-loving, knee-slapping Mike O'Neill sent around starts out with a picture, a graphic comparing, because it's no longer any fun to criticize President Obama. Now you have to go after his wife.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So the graphic accompanying this real knee-slapper of an email is a photograph on the left-hand side of the Grinch. And you know how he's got that tuft of hair that just kind of loops over forward? Dr. Seuss was so funny the way he'd draw people. Well, there's a picture of Michelle Obama getting her hair blown, and her hair is looped over forward, and the picture is titled "Twins Separated at Birth." The Grinch and the First Lady of the United States. And the text that accompanies it is, "Sorry, I just had to forward this latest holiday message. I've had worse hair days, but this is pretty funny. I'm sure you'll join me in wishing Mrs. Yo Mama a wonderful long Hawaii Christmas vacation at our expense, of course."
I think I just threw up a little bit in my mouth.
And when but here's the fun part. When he gets called on it, his office responded, "Political cartoons are a part of American culture."
No, they're not. Not like that.
So it took all day yesterday for him to get around to apologizing and said, "To those I have offended, I am sorry. That was not at all my intent." You know, another one of those right-wing non-apology apologies, Tracy.
You know, and it's so funny.
"I'm sorry if you were offended.
It was not my intent."
Well, what was your intent? What was his intent? To prove that he's a racist? To prove that he's a bigot? To prove that he's a misogynist?
But wait, it was ticked.
Because how do you... Mrs. Now, the Grinch thing is bad enough. But how do you explain away Mrs. Yo Mama?
Exactly.
And this creepy bastard's been on the planet for a while, so we know that he was around when George Bush achieved the record for being the President of the United States who had spent the most time of any president of the United States on vacation. He was around. But he didn't have anything to say about that because, you know, George was nice and white.
You know, and it's so funny. I joined this group called the Black Doll Affair, and basically it's a bunch of women of color, and the organization is to help promote self-awareness and black beauty for, you know, little girls. Because of course you heard about, you know, back in the day, the Brown versus the Board of Education, and the doll test, yes?
Yes.
And how the black kids preferred the white dolls over the black dolls they fit, you know. And so, you know, 50-some-odd years later, we're thinking it's over, right? That, you know, things are better.
Yeah, sorry, no.
You know, so this young lady back in, I guess it was like 04 or 05, did a recreation of the test. And guess what?
Has it changed?
No. Little black children still prefer the white doll over the black doll. So, so as a result, this woman, a sister in Atlanta, decided to, you know, get on Mattel and all this about making dolls for black girls that look like, you know, black dolls, like black people, black women. And for the first time, Mattel actually has finally given us a doll, you know, that was, you know, ethnically correct, if that's a proper term. I don't know, as far as, you know, ethnic features.
Yeah, and well, and that story's multi-layered, too, because whatever that color Barbie is...
She ain't a sister.
And she ain't much in the way of a female, either. Have you ever heard the actual dimensions if a woman was actually built like Barbie?
What was her measurement feet?
Oh, dear God, it was something insane like 36F1824.
Oh, my God.
Don't quote me, but the proportions were just ridiculous.
Right. So, basically, the lady that I met today, her name is Dana Hill, so we were on the phone for 2 hours, and one of the things that we talked about was our first lady and our president, and we were both concerned, you know, about how, you know, Barack needs a kick in the ass, and we both said that Michelle probably does yell at him every night to say, why do you insist upon thinking that these white people are going to listen to you? Why do you think that they're going to like you? They hate you. And see, what I love about Michelle is, like she always says, I wasn't elected for, you know, president. I'm the first lady. So therefore, I will talk shit. You know, she's like, Michelle Obama reminds me of me because of the fact that we'll speak kindly to you, but we don't have poker faces. So even though I'm being, you know, polite and whatnot and so forth, if you really look at my face, what I'm really saying to you is, if I get a chance, I'm going to cut your ass and watch you bleed. And for these people, yo mama?
Yeah, Mrs. Yo Mama. Show some respect now.
I'm sorry as I shake my head in awesome wonder. Mrs. Yo... You know, the racism, these people have lost their ever-loving mind. And that's one of the things, you know, about these enlightened white people who feel like they see the movies like The Blind Side and The Help, and they just think... Well,
all better now.
Everything's all better. It's not. And so she just so happens that her boyfriend is white from Boston. She's living in Atlanta. And she's constantly schooling him and his family about, you know, how these code words that these racists speak, you know, like, to see when
urban, guys, urban, ding, 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 urban.
You know, urban. When you and I hear, we want to get the White House back. You know, we want to take our country back.
It's not just the White House, it's the whole country.
And see, the enlightened white folks here, oh, they just wanted the Republicans back in power. And you, I, and now my new friend Dana, what we hear is get the nigga out the White House.
It's the truth. I'll never say that. I will never, ever say that.
You won't say that.
But it's true.
Get the black guy out the White House. You'll say get the black guy out the White House.
Out of, no, no, no. It's out of our White House.
Out of, exactly. Out of our White House. That's the code. You know, we're not saying take back our country to, you know, to bring it back to the family values and the times of the, like you were saying about the guy who came back from World War II and has, you know, come home from work, you know, after, you know, and with the evening paper and the smoking jacket and whatnot and so forth and voodoo, blah, 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 blee. That guy is gone.
Yeah. You know, I remember an episode, and this is certainly no reference on accuracy or reality, but I remember back when Happy Days was the great going concern that it was before Fonzie jumped the shark.
Yeah, before...
before Pinky Tuscadero and all of that.
Right.
Well, there was an episode about the presidential election, and Mr. Cunningham, you know, Richie's dad that ran the hardware store in Wisconsin... You know, he was an I like Ike. He was an Eisenhower Republican. And I think of him. I think of, Fred McMurray as Steve Douglas, who worked at the aerospace plant in Southern California in My Three Sons. There's your, you know, there's your Eisenhower Republican.
Exactly. Fred McMurray was a horrible racist, by the way.
See, that's why I brought it up. I don't just say things, Tracy. Hey, Tracy, you have yourself a wonderful evening. Have a safe shift and drive careful, will you?
Always, always.
All right. Take care and a wonder. And I don't know. Stop by the taco truck for me or something, would you?
I thought about you yesterday, and I didn't want to tell you, but I did stop by the taco truck with the deep fried shrimp taco.
No.
And the avocado.
Newman.
Like I said, when you come here, you know, I promise you.
I'm going to find that taco truck and I ain't leaving. But they're all over the place, right?
Well, not the deep fried shrimp taco stuff, no. But the regular street tacos, the little tacos, you know, with the...
And I'm going to get me an In-N-Out burger.
We can get you an In-N-Out burger when I pick you up from the airport, because there's one right by the airport.
All right, Tracy, you have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye, my dear.
Bye now. Tracy calling from L.A. Hey, welcome to the program.
I must love you, Bob. This is Richard. I've been on hold for 2 hours.
Well, thank you for staying.
Ah, well, we ain't got much time left. I just wanted to say hello to you and all the horny acts. And
oh, that's a new extension on the word, horny acts. I like that.
Yeah, and I had a few things in my own stack. Don't know if we got time for looking. Okay, let me mention this thing about moving money to credit unions.
Yes. Something I believe in. Is it going to be a problem?
No. It's just a heads up. 1996, I had a dilemma with my own bank. My bank had been, I had a nice regional bank, you know, San Francisco Bay Area region. And during the savings and loan scandal business, they got swallowed up by a bank that was owned by the Ford Motor Company. It was called First Nationwide Bank. And then they got bought by some California outfit, and they got bought by Citicorp. You know, and it's like a red flag went in front of me, you know. No way. I don't know if this is available in the rest of the country, but at least here in California, every bank, credit union, what have you, has to put out a document called a disclosure statement. Have you ever heard about that?
I'm familiar with them. I don't know if we're talking about the same disclosure statement, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But what the disclosure statement is it's usually a booklet or a pamphlet, and it displays all of the rules and regulations that apply to your account, and especially the fees. So before you open an account, you can go to the bank and you can ask for this and they'll give it to you. And then you can look at it and see, do I really want to do business with these bastards or not? Because you'll find all kinds of interesting things buried in that document. You know, and going to Citicorp's disclosure statement, it became black and white that they were ripping people off right and left with their fees, which were just unreal. You know, like in 1996, they were charging people $30 to bounce your, you know, if you bounced a check.
Oh, yeah. That's where that brutal predatory stuff came from.
And you know, and I went into...
And the fees may not be much lower at a credit union, but they are less ruthlessly applied. Is that a fair statement?
Not necessarily, because all the credit unions are different from one another, and this is the thing that that I wanted to mention, is, you know, in general what I found, because I got these disclosure statements for a lot of different places, and... I mean, one of them was a bank I wanted, you know, I was thinking about moving my money to. It's called Union Bank. It's owned by Japanese, in Japan. And, you know, I went through it, and then, you know, this one line that said, it said, we can do whatever we want to with your financial information. You know? And I think, hey, wait a minute. No way. You know?
Yeah, I mean, we'll take your, if we want to, and we're bored in the board meeting, we'll take your financial information. We'll make a paper airplane and fly it off the 30th floor.
Right, exactly.
Like it.
We'll publish it. So I was doing a project for the phone company at the time, and I was now you had to be somebody who they wanted. You know, a credit union had to be. You had to have some kind of affinity interest with them. You couldn't just join any old credit union. You see, for instance, the Patelco Credit Union, Patelco. I mean, the Pacific Telephone Company was started by telephone company workers. And so initially, the only people who could join it were phone company people. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
You know, there's probably some credit union not too far from you, which is structured the same way. Later on, they got more open and wanted to be open to just about anybody.
Well, the one that I grew up with was the credit union that was founded to serve the people who worked at the plant where my father worked.
Exactly.
And it later on expanded and just tried to, you know, horn into the market. And yeah. It became more ruthless and more brutal as it did so and stopped being a lot less like a credit union.
That's my point. So some are very nice and inclusive and democratic, and others... you don't want to be with them. I joined a credit union that actually had different classes of membership at different tiers. So if you were a high roller, you could stand on a special line that was short and get seen quickly, just like you were a businessman. And if you were, you know, if you had a small account, well, you had to stand in line, you know, long line for the peasants.
Oh, without a doubt. Well, I am sorry I got to you so late, but let's start over in the new week, okay?
Okay, it's a deal, Bob.
All right, take care, Richard. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. Bye.
Bye now. Our good buddy Richard calling from Northern California. And that does it for the week. Thank you very kindly for all of your participation all week long. Thanks to everybody who makes the program go. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go there, sign up for the email newsletter, join up, maybe make a donation, get a t-shirt. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. As always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.